the first plan. Now, all of these changes in industry brought about by the first five-year plan, by Stalin's revolution from above, were considerable. But there were in some ways even more dramatic changes in agriculture. Like industrialization, agrarian development was also treated as a political, one might say, as a military campaign. Or in the language of the times, this was class war against exploiters, against people known as kulaks, richer peasants. And on the side of the state in this class war against the richer peasants were said to be the poor peasants who were allied with the proletariat, which meant the state and the party. Partly this was accurate, though in reality this was more a class war of the proletarian state, as it saw itself, against the entire peasantry as a class. This was a gradual intensifying attack against peasants in the years from about 1927 when it first started through 1930 when it reached its pinnacle. It began in the winter of 1927-28 with the resumption of forced grain requisitioning. The problem of grain not being delivered in sufficient quantity became so severe that the state, this time pushed by Stalin against the protests already of Bukharin, though he was still in power, sent armed battalions, mainly of workers and communists in the countryside, to insist, as during the Civil War, that they hand grain over at prices, low prices, set by the state. And this was repeated again, actually, in the fall of 1928 and again in 1929. The immediate results of these campaigns of resumed forced grain requisitioning, the immediate results, were in a certain sense good. A large amount of additional grain turned out to be in the hands of peasants and was collected. But the long-term effects, as during forced grain requisitioning during the Civil War, were less promising. Peasants responded to the resumption of forced grain requisitioning by sowing less land. They wanted to make sure there was nothing extra beyond what they needed to eat that would be collected, resulting in less to collect, and hence the return threat of starvation once again in the cities. So Stalin decided to cut the Gordian knot and attack more aggressively. The end of 1929, he announced a campaign on two fronts. First, he announced in December of 29 to eliminate, as he put it, eliminate kulaks as a class. Actually, the word literally was to liquidate kulaks as a class. And second, within a few months, in January of 1930, total and rapid collectivization of all peasants was decreed. What this meant in practice was something intense and violent. Hundreds of thousands of better-off peasants, kulaks, and in fact, many people that couldn't remotely be described as kulaks, were evicted from their homes by these same squads of communists and workers, and their property entirely confiscated. More than half of all remaining peasants were forced into collective farms within a matter of months, and the rest were forced in the next year or so. The extent of this collectivization, peasants being forced into collective farms, was extreme. Virtually everything was declared to be the property of this new collective farm, a kolkhoz, as it was called in Russian. Land, houses, tools, animals, even private furniture and clothing was now said to belong to the collective farm. And finally, as if to underscore that this was a class war, very much like the sort of class war we saw during the Civil War period, these collectivizers from the cities also beat up or arrested various class enemies, such as priests or the local school teacher. And sometimes the actions were much worse, again, as during the Civil War. Drunken fighting, stealing clothes for personal use, taking icons out of peasants' house and smearing food on them, or worse, rape, murder, and much else. Peasants resisted all this in a number of different ways. Some of them resisted actively. Officials and volunteers from the cities were occasionally met on the road, beaten up, stoned, shot at, sometimes killed. More common, though, was mass peasant passive resistance. These peasants sometimes simply abandoned the countryside, saying, I'm not going to live on a collective farm. I'll go work in the city. Better work in a factory rather than become a collective farmer with no land, with no freedom. So severe was this outflow of peasants that the state in 1931 had to institute an internal passport system that prevented people from moving anywhere in the country without approval by the state. Most peasants, though, in a very typical peasant way, simply remained and accepted their fate, but before they gave in, engaged in one last gesture of resistance. Rather than hand their animals over to the collective farm, which they saw as nothing but a branch of the state, they slaughtered vast numbers of horses and cows and pigs and chickens. They ate as much as they could in these huge banquets of overindulgence, but most of it was simply left to rot in the fields all around the Soviet Union, a sort of visible, tangible symbol of how much peasants resented this action. Now, the results of collectivization were in some ways mixed, like those of industrialization. From the peasant, from the state's point of view, this actually went quite well. Their main goals were achieved. Grain procurements were now much higher. They could force peasants to work, and all the grain could be delivered to the state except the minimal needed for them to eat. Also, it was very pleasing to many communists that peasants were now firmly under the political control of the state. Indeed, collective farms were branches of the state. The traditional peasant commune, where peasants gathered to make decisions in their traditional life, was abolished in 1930 with collectivization, and in its place stood the administration of the kolkhoz, of the collective farm, staffed mostly by appointed officials, often from the city. In other ways, though, agriculture suffered enormously. Sullen peasants generally refused to exert themselves, though could be forced, though the grain could be taken away and other food products, they would work as if under serfdom, as weakly, as poorly as possible. In fact, many peasants themselves began to refer to all this as if it were serfdom returned. And they began to notice that the initials for the All-Russian Communist Party, or then the All-Soviet Communist Party, VKP, were also the initials for the Russian term second serfdom. It seemed to them a symbol of what this was all about. Productivity in agriculture also suffered enormously from this massive slaughter of livestock at the end, in the midst of collectivization. This affected how much fertilizer was available. There was very little manufactured. Most came from animals. The amount of draft power was much reduced. There were very few tractors yet. Therefore, there was very little left to pull the plows. And animal products and dairy products, meat and milk, were much less available now in the cities. From a different and maybe even more important point of view, the most serious consequence of collectivization, though, was its toll on human lives, on peasants themselves. For all peasants, a traditional way of life was suddenly and almost overnight destroyed, not in the gradual way we saw peasant life changing, but dramatically and suddenly. Many peasants, in fact, adding to all of this loss of their of a way of life, also lost their lives. Maybe millions, it's estimated by most historians, died in the process of collectivization. They died when they were arrested as kulaks and sent to the camps. Many died on the way. They died when they were shot, as some groups were, for being enemies of collectivization. And the largest number died during a horrible famine in 1932-33, mostly in Ukraine, and many people believe this famine to have been engineered by the state, that available grain in other parts of the country was deliberately withheld from peasants, where harvests were bad, in order to force them to submit through starvation. Now, it's sometimes hard to remember, when recounting the horrors of these years, that this was also a time of heroic idealism. In many ways, in fact, these two faces were inseparable for understanding this first Stalinist revolution. Irrationality and brutality and suffering, on the one hand, was linked with idealism and optimism and making a sense of making a better world. One sign of this was a pervasive idea at the time that this first five-year plan's revolution was not only an economic revolution, but also a cultural revolution, creating a new society with new values. In the language of the time, this meant asserting a new proletarian culture against the old bourgeois culture. And this was to be a fierce struggle, a class struggle for the new. One aspect of this cultural revolution what is called social purging. This meant various public trials against people known as bourgeois experts. This mainly meant engineers, not from a working class background. And this started in 1928 when many engineers were accused of sabotage against the Soviet state. They were arrested, they were tried very briefly, they were imprisoned, and they were often sent to the camps. Even more important, communists everywhere in every part of society were encouraged to challenge the role of what were called non-proletarian experts, no matter where they worked. And here, proletarian meant not just of working class background, but also not holding to proletarian ideology. This struggle took place everywhere, in almost every profession and institution, schools and factories, even orchestras. In part, this cultural revolution, this social purging, this fight against members of the old classes or old ideologies was directed from above, very much directed from above. And yet it's clear that some of this took place, increasing amounts of it took place spontaneously, that local people, individuals, found this movement to be appealing for their own reasons, exciting even. For example, students at universities felt they had good reasons, positive reasons of their own, to attack non-party professors. They would hiss at non-communist lecturers during their courses. They would call them names, bourgeois, typically. They would shout out criticism. They would, in many schools, insisted that all professors had to stand for re-election so that only communist professors could be elected. And in fact, many existing professors in universities were replaced by young communists. The same was going on in workplaces and professions all around the country, where people were being replaced mainly by young working class communists. There's a strong element of class in all this, and a strong element of generational struggle. Purging professors and writers and bureaucrats and engineers allowed young communists, especially from worker background, to move into positions of authority. Opening up educational institutions to workers also made it easier for lower class individuals to rise into positions of greater influence through education. But it's worth saying these were struggles not just about class, not just about generation, the young against the old, but also about ideas. There were, frankly, for many, many of these people involved in this cultural revolution, a desire to transform everything about life that accompanied this industrial revolution, this process of collectivization. Consider, for example, developments in education during the first five-year plan, such as the efforts by an educational theorist named Shulgin. He argued that everything about Soviet education during the 1920s was simply too bourgeois. It wasn't a dramatic enough transformation of life. The problem with schools, he said, is they're elitist. They're divorced from everyday life. And what was needed was what he liked to call proletarian education. Schools should turn into communes in which teachers and students worked cooperatively and not only studied together, but literally labored together. And there was an argument that part of schooling should be engagement in real productive labor. There was a very common view in these years that work with your hands, physical work, was purifying, morally uplifting, and therefore should be part of the moral education of every child. Equally interesting and telling were ideas during these same years of industrialization and collectivization among city planners. Various proposals were put forward and discussed widely in the press for a new proletarian city. Indeed, there were many national competitions to come up with these plans. These proletarian cities were all highly visionary. For example, a spiral city was suggested, or a city in the shape of a parabola. In fact, many cities were meant to have a mathematical structure, and complex formulae were shown about the origins of the city as making a city happier through science, in this case, math. A very widespread idea was the idea of linear green cities, in which there would be lines of industry followed by lines of parks and then lines of housing, and would be a more humane setting. Certain features stand out in all these various city planning ideas. One, as you can see, is a radical modernism, a reliance on science and technology, even mathematics. Electricity is very important to these city plans, modern transportation. There was great faith in the transformative possibilities of modernity in all of its aspects. At the same time, one can see what might be described as a sort of anti-modern ideal in these city plans, a desire to get rid of the whole traditional modern city altogether, perhaps even get rid of the state as unnecessary in this new, well-planned society. And in particular, to create a city or a society without cities that had no compulsion, that was the ideal of what communism should be all about. And a good example of this are the ideas, rather typical of the time, of a sociologist named Akhidovich working with two architects named Sokolov and Ginzburg. And they envisioned a socialist world in the near future that would have no permanent settlements at all. Everything was to be in motion. Power would come from a big universal grid that you could tap into anywhere. Railway stations are everywhere, as are in the air dirigibles and airplanes flying about. It's a highly modern vision. Even housing was to be mobile. You could pick up your portable housing cell and plug it into the electric grid wherever you wanted. And you can see this is a vision of the withering away of the city, but also of the family, seen as also a type of compulsion. These were one-person housing cells, and people could come together freely in any way they wanted. It was also meant to be a collective society, but in a free and natural way. As Akhidovich, one of the designers of this plan, suggested, the stronger the collective links between people, the stronger the individual will be. This deserves emphasis because though these radicals all dreamed of extensive transformation, they believed that it wasn't enough to just change the external world. One had to change the inside of individuals to liberate them fundamentally. For example, one of these designers, an architect named Melnikov, suggested that all his cities needed to include sleep laboratories, where thousands of sleeping citizens would be gently inundated with these sounds and smells that were selected by scientists for their collectivist associations. However bizarre this might sound and rather unfree, a sort of weird sort of musical and sensory brainwashing, the idea for them was that collectivism, their goal, should emerge not through force, but naturally, gradually. In other words, these were strange times, these years of Stalin's revolution, times of enormous centralized control, brutality, violence, but also times of idealism and enthusiasm and optimism, creating better lives. No wonder, then, that historians have debated so fiercely about the meanings of these particular years of the first five-year plan of Stalin's revolution. I've been to conferences where I've seen scholars literally screaming at one another over different interpretations of this period, literally breaking into tears. On the one hand, there are those who argue for the absolute totalitarian nature of the first five-year plan, the coercion, the violence, the suffering. On the other are scholars who say this isn't just a story of tyranny and victimization, though it's that, that people embraced Stalin's revolution for their own reasons, that they believed they were creating a better world. The truth, as you can see, I'm suggesting, is some combination of both, the contradictoriness of the Stalinist revolution. Next lecture, I'm going to continue this story into the 1930s, a time when the party in some way retreated from some of these radical plans, when life became in some ways more normal, more easy, more pleasant, but also a time that witnessed the most bloody coercion yet, called the Great Terror.
Lecture 32, Joy and Terror, Society and Culture in the 1930s.
In this lecture, we look at a period of Soviet history that may well be among the most enigmatic, of the Stalinist 1930s. Scholars have argued passionately in recent years over the meaning of this period in Soviet life. For these were years in many ways in which the Stalinist political and social and cultural order really was most fully developed. It's sometimes described as high Stalinism. As in debates about the first five-year plan, some scholars have insisted on the fundamentally totalitarian nature of the Stalinist 1930s. They focus on the use of absolute dictatorial power, on indoctrination, on terror, in which most ordinary people were seen as only victims. Other scholars, often described as revisionists, argue that the Stalinist system couldn't possibly rule only through coercion and terror. And they point out the way in which the regime found support in the population for many of its policies, that it had its loyalists, even true believers, and certainly many beneficiaries, that in many ways the system was responsive to people's desires and even their values. And this explains its strength and survival alongside coercion and even terror. Now, as a matter of interpretation about the meaning of these years, I'll leave this to you to make your own judgment on how to balance terror and force, and on the other hand, social responsiveness in the system. But I will emphasize the one inescapable fact. It is clear that there is plentiful evidence for both sides of this argument in every aspect of Stalin's 1930s. Plenty of terror and force and coercion, not to mention subtler forms of cultural and psychological control, and a great deal of support and enthusiasm, and even, I would say, a good deal of ordinary, everyday happiness. And this contradictory picture is the subject of this lecture. First, it's clear that in many ways the 1930s was indeed a time of overwhelming authoritarian power, indeed what is best called tyranny. In numerous ways, the state and party, which were essentially one, sought control of every aspect of life. This was in many ways a regime that tried to create a totalitarian society and went a long way toward doing so. A cultural iron curtain, as it would later be called, surrounded the country. It became almost impossible in the 1930s to travel abroad. Censorship was intense, not only limiting what could be said, which was just about anything critical of the state or any alternative ideas, but also forbidding the import of most books and periodicals from other parts of the world. In fact, even older books that held contrary views existing in Russian libraries, in Soviet libraries, were separated out from the main collection and put in separate locked collections. Russian culture was made more uniform than it had really ever before been in Russian history. The freedom, the relative freedom and diversity that one found, for example, in the press and discussions of ideas and in art and literature during the 1920s, a period that saw all sorts of creative experiments in writing and in artistic creation and in sculpture, many of which continued the avant-garde traditions of the early revolutionary and pre-revolutionary years. All of this was essentially ended in the 1930s. Uniformity, ideological orthodoxy became the rule. And this orthodoxy became in many ways quite conservative. All forms of creative, avant-garde experimentalism was abandoned. Art and literature in many ways were to follow realistic, accessible traditions of the past. And most importantly, to be positive, to be optimistic, to have no doubt, to suggest no complexity about the building of socialism. It was to be a heroic art and literature and world of ideas, all called officially socialist realism, was to be the dominant form in art and literature. In everyday social and cultural life, experimentation such as we saw earlier in the 20s and certainly even in the first five-year plan period was discouraged in the 1930s. For example, policies developed in the 1920s about family policy, seen as emancipating women and children even, were reversed. Greater ceremony was restored to what was now said to be an essential institution in Soviet life, marriage and the family. Divorce was made now very difficult and expensive to obtain. Homosexuality, which had largely been ignored, was now made formally a criminal offense. Abortion was outlawed as working against the power and strength of the traditional family. And in the press, if you were reading any Soviet newspaper, one would find regular articles extolling the glories of the traditional family life and the role of women within the family as, above all, mothers. Even the social radicalism we saw during the first five-year plan period was in many ways abandoned by orders from above. For example, these attacks on non-communists, non-worker engineers and professors and other so-called bourgeois experts were formally called off in 1931. Income inequality, which was seen as unsocialist, and equalization of the incomes of all people because everybody contributed something useful, this movement toward income equality was also reversed in the 1930s. In addition, sort of reinforcing this, status and rank was in many ways seen as a good thing, as a useful thing, and it was to be reinforced by a privilege, which of course was seen as sustaining loyalty. Privileges were seen as symbolizing success. For example, engineers and managers and heroic workers, who were known as shock workers, were given as a reward for their status and rank and achievement separate eating places, and indeed one should say better eating places, nicer surroundings, better food. Bigger and better apartments in the 1930s were built for members of the elite. Special stores were established where they can buy scarce goods. Special resorts were set up for the elite of party and state and industry. Even special parks just for the elite. In education, to give another example, similarly one sees a dramatic reverse toward traditional forms. All the various experiments and educational methods that existed after the revolution and in the 1920s and even in the first five-year plan period were replaced. Instead, formal learning became the rule. Rote memorization, using approved texts, homework, all of this was reinstated. And strict classroom discipline, not the sort of open collectivism talked about in earlier years, was to be the norm. To symbolize this, in fact, all students were obliged to wear school uniforms that looked remarkably like the uniforms students wore before the revolution. In other words, this Stalinist 1930s was an increasingly conservative society. Order, stability, control were the prime values. Another sign of this totalitarian culture of power was a cult of the leader. In particular, this meant Stalin himself, but also posthumously Lenin, who was seen as the leader behind the leader who Stalin in some ways embodied in himself. Everywhere in Russian Soviet society, one saw huge pictures of Stalin and Lenin. Their statements appeared everywhere. In fact, no writer, no scholar could afford to write anything without quoting Stalin and preferably Lenin as well. No matter what the subject, they must have something relevant to say on the matter. Huge ceremonies were staged during the 1930s and well reported in the press and on radio, in which citizens were brought forward, children beautifully dressed, singing songs about their love of Comrade Stalin, the idealism of what a great leader he was. Many of these ceremonies were quite elaborate adulations of Stalin. More ominously, the 1930s were a time of extensive, constant mobilization as if for war against external enemies who threatened the country and against internal enemies who were there posing danger at every turn. Newspapers and posters that were seen in public spaces, lessons in education in the schools, even movies were filled with propagandistic appeals to mobilize for construction, to mobilize for production, and above all, to be on guard against enemies everywhere, and of course, to take action against internal enemies. Denunciations were encouraged against anybody who was against socialism, and many people were arrested already in the early 1930s. At its most extreme, though this would in some ways seem to contradict the desire for order and stability to take prime place, the 1930s, the mid and late 1930s, were a time of open terror, a violent repression on a wide scale such as this country had never seen before. The part of this best known, certainly to the world, were a series of show trials of prominent communists that took place between August 1936 and March 1938. In these trials, leading old Bolsheviks, as they were called, communists who had been in the party since before 1917, were arrested, put on trial, and accused of, and very often forced to confess to, in public, absolutely implausible political crimes. They admitted to, or were accused of, conspiring to murder Stalin, of plotting to overthrow the Soviet state and dismember the USSR with, it was sometimes said, the help of Germany and Japan. Leading old Bolsheviks were accused of, and sometimes, and indeed forced often, to confess to plotting the restoration of capitalism in the USSR. And generally, they were all accused for good measure of carrying on various forms of espionage and what was called wrecking or sabotage and even terrorism on behalf of capitalists and fascists and, for good measure, a Trotsky, who had been expelled from the country and then was living in the 1930s in Mexico, where he was said to lead this alliance of capitalists and fascists and communists, former communists, against Stalin. Most of the victims of these trials, all high-ranking communists, comrades in most cases of Lenin personally in the pre-revolutionary days, most of them were executed as a result of these show trials. Many Russians, especially Russian communists, were stunned. Never before, despite purges, despite exclusions from the party, despite even arrests, had a high-ranking party member, somebody at the highest ranks, an old Bolshevik, been executed for his criticisms. Indeed, we remember Kamenev and Zinoviev were even brought back into the Politburo after 1917. These show trials, however shocking they were to many, were only the tip of an iceberg. An iceberg of terror that reached very deeply into Soviet life. Among the rank and file of the party, which numbered almost 3 million people by 1936, one saw, as these show trials began, a parallel to them, a frenzy of denunciations. Constant meetings were held at every place of work, in universities, in factories, in offices, in which people got together to denounce these enemies of the regime who were on trial, and their minions at their place of work or study. Those people who were caught up in these denunciations were usually within meetings held among communists within those institutions. They were thrown out of the party. They were imprisoned. They were perhaps tortured in order to confess. By the middle of 1937, torture became quite common. They were then sent to a labor camp for their crimes or perhaps shot. And not only party members suffered in this process. Large numbers of non-communist officials and military officers and engineers and scientists and scholars and writers and others were publicly condemned at various meetings held where they worked or in organizations they belonged to, condemned as belonging to one of these various oppositions for which they were dismissed from their jobs, arrested, perhaps shot, perhaps if they were lucky, sent only to a labor camp in Siberia where they might die in the horrible conditions or be shot later. In fact, this is the period in the mid and late 1930s when the growing network of camps that had already begun to exist during the Civil War became massive and became known by its famous acronym as the Gulag, a word that comes from the beginning of the Russian phrase, the main directorate for corrective labor camps, which was the official name of the Gulag. First two words start with the letters for Gu and Log. Also caught up in this growing wave of terror falling deeper and deeper into society were a whole variety of other groups, not only high officials, not only communists. Foreign communists, for example, were often victimized in the terror. Many of them had come to the Soviet Union precisely to escape the repressions of Hitler or Mussolini. What they now found was Stalin. Advocates of Esperanto were accused of belonging to an international conspiracy that was seen as subversive of communism. They were in large numbers arrested and sent to the camps or shot. Non-Russian nationalities were also particularly targeted, accused of bourgeois nationalism. Religious believers, especially peasants who refused to work on feast days, were arrested and punished as a particular targeted group. And in fact, anybody who was asked by the secret police to serve as an informer within their place of work or among their friends or in their organization, if you refused to be an informer, you were certainly an enemy of the people and you would suffer the same fate. At its worst, even children were expected to denounce their parents and their neighbors for any criticisms they might have overheard of the regime of Stalin personally. And those children who were known to have turned in their parents, for whom arrest and exile and sometimes execution followed, those heroic children were publicly praised in the schools and in the press as role models for every young Soviet child to follow. The scope of this terror is, in fact, difficult to measure. We have no reliable statistics, but we have some sense of its dimensions. Communists suffered disproportionately. Almost the entire pre-revolutionary Bolshevik leadership was exterminated between 1936 and 1938. For example, of the entire Politburo, the political bureau, the leaders of the party, in 1924, after Lenin's death, his heirs, in a way, almost every one of them, including, of course, Bukharin, were shot or committed suicide before they were arrested, knowing what was inevitable. Only two people from the 1924 Politburo survived after the end of the 1930s. One of them was Trotsky, who was no longer in the country. He was living in Mexico, but the secret police caught up with him by 1940, and he was assassinated in his home, leaving only one survivor of the 1924 Politburo, Stalin. In fact, even the Central Committee of 1934, mostly post-1917 members, most of them pro-Stalin in the earlier years, of those, 80% were executed or driven to suicide before they could be arrested and shot. And the rank and file of the party did little better than the leadership. Of 2.8 million party members registered in 1934, the one where we have fairly clear records, about a million of these were arrested and perhaps as many as two-thirds executed. In addition to the party, other institutions were also decimated by the terror, notably the Red Army. A massive purge began in the army in 1937. This is a time in which war was looming. At least everybody in the press and in the government was talking about the likely threat of an invasion, probably coming from Nazi Germany, but perhaps from the whole Western world. At this moment, with war anticipated, half of the entire officer corps was executed during this great purge, something like 35,000 men. Almost all senior officers were arrested and mostly executed. In fact, some have argued that Hitler, who knew about this purge of the army, was encouraged to attack Russia 4 years later, knowing the army was still so weak in terms of leadership. No one knows the exact numbers of people who perished and suffered during the Great Terror. Several million, we know, were arrested, mostly common people, but disproportionately elites. The estimates of the number who were shot and died in the camps ranges from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions. And I should add that the effects of the terror were not limited just to those who were arrested and sent to the camps and perhaps shot. Not only the immediate victims suffered, but this person's friends, their relatives, family members, all should be counted in some ways as victims of the Great Terror. Now, this horrible story of repression and terror is part of the story of the 1930s, but only part of it. To truly make sense of this time, one also has to take note of and try to make sense of what might seem like its opposite, a story of public pleasure and joy in the 1930s. In 1936, just as the terror was getting underway, Stalin offered a new guiding slogan. Life has become better. Life has become more joyful, comrades. And this phrase was heard everywhere. Songs repeated it. Posters, in the movies, in the press, in speeches. And its spirit was, in fact, already emerging before this formal declaration of this slogan in 1936. Stalin's face in the mid-30s began to appear in public as a rather nice and genial fellow. As his face appeared more and more often, it became more and more fatherly as people describe it, as dear and beloved. He was often smiling or seen patting children on the head. There were also in the press pervasive images of prosperity and happiness in art, in literature, in newspapers, in posters. And it's worth emphasizing, this wasn't just an image. There was, in 1930 society, a growing emphasis on material rewards that would come from hard work and loyalty. As I've suggested, older ideals of egalitarianism and work for the benefit of work itself were abandoned in favor of material rewards for work and loyalty. A good illustration is the famous Stakhanovist movement. At first glance, this would seem like the classic totalitarian mobilization of society for production. It was named after a man named Alexei Stakhanov, a coal miner who, after organizing a team of assistants, was able to hew 14 times his daily norm. The government set him up and his work as a model, and thousands of people across the country were mobilized to emulate Stakhanov in overproducing. Now, if this had happened in the early Stalinist years, in the first five-year plan, Stakhanov and his followers would have been idealized for their heroism, for their sacrifices for socialism, but not in the mid-1930s. By then, the emphasis was on personal and material rewards. Press reports, in fact, made a point of describing Stakhanovites acquiring bicycles and pianos and phonographs and records and radios and good china and nice linen and good suits and ties as a reward for their achievement. And it described them as spending their leisure time not just at party meetings, but at dances and parties with their happy families. Or consider this news report. This comes from the Communist Party's official paper, Pravda, The Truth, about a New Year's Eve party for Stakhanovites in 1936. It says, the brigadier welder, V. Baranov, 28, the best Stakhanovite at the Elektrozavod factory, glided across the floor in a slow tango with Shura Ovchinnikova, 20, the best Stakhanovite at some other factory. He was dressed in a black Boston suit that fully accentuated his solidly built figure. She was in a crepe de chine dress and with black shoes and white trimming. The message like this, which one saw so often, was of course directed at this new upwardly mobile class. But it was also by extension meant to appeal to the whole population. It was an allure. It was a promise. It was a suggestion that if you too work hard, this is the reward. Not heroism, but material benefit. And ads in all the papers of the time, Communist Party papers in the 1930s, would often show new stylish fashions that could be bought at the local department store, nice hats, nice shoes, ties, and the like. Now, another major expression of this encouraged, in fact, one might say, required mood of happiness and optimism were popular entertainments in the 1930s. For example, in Moscow, a park called Gorky Park, named after the famous writer, became a sort of communist Disneyland, an escape park for pleasure. A theater was set up where light musical entertainment became the norm. A big dance island was set up so people could dance, especially in the summer, late into the evening. Carnivals were organized with torchlight parades and costume figures and amusements and rides and music and dance and fireworks, even during the darkest days of the terror. The 30s were also a time of a revived popularity of jazz as part of the pleasure of the time. In fact, during the early Stalinist years, there was an assault in the first five-year plan period, an assault on jazz, which was quite popular in the 1920s and seen to be as encouraging sexual license and drug use and homosexuality. This was now banned in the 1930s for these reasons, in the first five-year plan period. In fact, there was even a ban suggested during the first five-year plan on saxophones, seen as a symbol of decadent music. But after 1931, all this changed. Jazz proliferated. In fact, one of the most popular jazzmen of the 1930s was a man named Alexander Zwassmann, who called himself Bob sounded a little jazzier, a little more American. And indeed, he played mostly American music. And as a result of his and other bands, Russians everywhere were listening to songs like The Man I Love, or In a Shanty in an Old Shanty Town, or a big hit in the 1930s, Chattanooga Choo Choo. The mood was fun, even amidst the terror. City parks all over the country organized big dances, the music usually being American, dances being the tango and the foxtrot and the rumba and the Boston waltz, and even outlasting jazz, which began to be seen as a little more dubious than at first by the later 1930s, outlasting its Soviet life became pervaded with light and romantic popular songs, Russian songs and gypsy songs and even some foreign songs. Or consider the cinema in the 1930s, the second half of the 1930s. To be sure, it had its share of political propaganda, though it was more about patriotism and heroism than actually building socialism by this period. But most popular and widely available, which under even a very controlled cultural regime, were films that focused on adventure and romance and, above all, fun. In fact, comedies were extremely popular even during the days of the terror. The most popular, in fact, were musical comedies, all filled with sunny optimism and lively music. For example, a rather typical film was a film from 1934, but it continued to play throughout the late 30s, called Happy-Go-Lucky Guys. And the highlights included, for example, a cheery shepherd, who was the hero of this film, always smiling and joking and singing, who falls in love. An orchestra that he gets involved with, filled with white pianos and pearl-studded white double basses. Lots of very fun toe-tapping songs by a popular Russian-Soviet jazz band that actually appeared in the film that never lets anything get it down. In fact, at one point, they all have a big fist fight just for fun, and they destroy all their instruments in the pleasure, and then realize somehow they have to play without instruments. That doesn't bother them either. They're always cheery and happy. And the whole film ends with a joyous finale at a congress of Stakhanovite workers in the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow. Pleasure and joy. In fact, even architecture tried to express the slogan that life has become more joyful, though in telling ways. First of all, there's constant construction during the 1930s, especially in the capital, Moscow. Government offices, apartment buildings for officials and Stakhanovites and others, still today considered the nicest, best built, most attractive buildings built in the country. They were meant to create spaces for people to have happy family lives. But also, there were extensive spaces built for the public to show that the state cares about them. Big squares and parks for the public to gather. Huge grand boulevards, well set out with benches and lamps and nice plantings. An elegantly decorated subway system in Moscow. Theaters, clubs, headquarters of civic organizations. All were built to create a sense of pleasure and comfort. The metro, the subway in Moscow, is a rather typical and telling example. The first line was constructed in the mid-1930s, and it continued in later years. And in every one of these stations, especially those built under Stalin, we see the most elaborate and aesthetically traditional efforts to make the subway, where so many would go to get to work and travel about the city, as a symbol of a thriving and happy public life. Every station looked, and still looks, like an underground palace with walls and floors of marble, with elaborate, beautiful mosaics, with sculptures, with stained glass, with elegant chandeliers. Meanwhile, of course, most Muscovites, not the elite, and when they're not in public, lived in crowded communal apartments, three or five or more crowded into a room, sharing several families, sharing a single bathroom, a single kitchen, a single toilet. How can one make sense of all of this? Of this combination of conservatism and continual ideological mobilization, this mixture of joy and terror. Some would argue this is all about being responsive to popular tastes, popular desires. This is what people wanted. Others have argued that this is part of the way the system controlled people. It gave them reasons to accept the absolute power of the new order. It masked reality. I consider a comment made a number of years later about one of the most popular musical comedies of the 1930s, a film called Circus, which showed how happy everyone was in Soviet life, and in particular, how all the various ethnic groups and nationalities got along so well, unlike, as the film suggests, in the racist U.S. This film, it was said by a Soviet who remembered it, helped stifle the shots that killed several generations of revolutionaries. It masked Stalin's ruthlessness and great Russian chauvinism, and it presented to the world the benign face of an idealistic socialist state on the march. Or one might ask, was this something still more complex and contradictory at its very essence? Next time, we'll see what happened in Soviet life as this contradictory political and social order confronted its greatest external challenge, the invasion from Nazi Germany.
Lecture 33, The Great Patriotic War.
On June 22, 1941, the armies of Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union with the stated goal of overthrowing communist rule in Russia, subjugating this country, and indeed all the Slavic lands. This invasion and the war that followed was a disaster, of course, resulted in enormous death and destruction and suffering in the Soviet Union. It was also, though, a story of considerable irony. It had been long anticipated. The Soviet Union, yet, despite this expectation of war for some years, was initially terribly unprepared. And the war, in another way, was ironic in that it was a certain blessing in disguise for the Soviet Union. It enormously strengthened popular acceptance of Soviet power, what might, one might even say the legitimacy of the entire Soviet system, for the first full time. In fact, to this day, nostalgia that exists in post-communist Russia, nostalgia for Soviet communism, tends to be tied up with memories of the war years. And this story, the story of this war, is the subject of this lecture. In many ways, as I suggested, this war had long been anticipated, expected, and of course, feared. Since 1917, when the communists came to power, Soviet leaders had been constantly predicting that there would be some great confrontation between the capitalist world and the communist world, which of course meant the USSR. This seemed especially likely in the 1930s with the rise of fascism in Italy and Germany and Russia. The Soviet Union saw fascism as simply the highest, most extreme form of a capitalist system in crisis. And in fact, the party and the press constantly talked about the likelihood of and the reality of various fascist conspiracies against the USSR. Indeed, one of the key themes, as you'll recall, of the Great Terror was that various Russians were said to be in ally with the fascists. At the same time, because they anticipated such an eventual battle, Soviet leaders did everything they could to try to prevent or at least delay such a war. From 1934 to 1938, Soviet diplomacy followed a policy that was known as collective security. This was a major effort to convince the Western powers, especially Great Britain, France, and the United States, to unite with the USSR in a major and sustained and robust effort to contain the spread of fascism, to contain in particular the danger of a German expansion connected with Nazism. This effort proved in vain. The West, especially Britain, preferred a policy that became known as appeasement to a policy that the Soviets called containment. Also, it's a simple fact that the Western countries, in particular Britain, France, and the United States, simply didn't trust the communist Soviets as potential allies. And so this policy got nowhere. As a result, the Soviet Union decided to go it alone. And in order to prevent a war, made a deal with Germany. The 1939 non-aggression pact, in which both countries agreed not to attack one another, at least not to be the first to attack. And this pact gave the USSR critical space and critical time to prepare for the threat of war. It gave them space in the sense of a buffer zone of newly occupied Western territories, including much of Poland and the whole Baltic region, which was part of a secret agreement connected to the non-aggression pact. This allowed the Soviets to move into these lands to give them a buffer zone. It also gave the Soviet Union important time. Now that the Germans would inevitably, as it was clear once the Germans took their part of Poland, be engaged in a war with the Western powers, this would, of course, allow, again, more time for the Soviet Union to prepare for a war. And yet, despite all the talk about war, despite all of these efforts to give them space and time, when Germany finally invaded the USSR 2 years later, the Soviet leadership and the army and the economy was shockingly unprepared. We see this in the very first days of the war. Most of the Russian Air Force was destroyed on the ground within a few days of the attack. Thousands of tanks were destroyed or captured. Hundreds of thousands, maybe as many as a million soldiers, were captured just in the first weeks of the war. And Stalin, evidently completely shocked by this event, fell into a week of stunned silence, where he sat at his dacha, reportedly doing nothing but looking at a wall, leaving it to his foreign minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, to make the announcement that the Soviet Union was now at war, and indeed for a week to manage affairs without Stalin's participation. And the situation only got worse, though Stalin himself recovered and became an active part in the war effort. By late November of 1941, only 5 months into the war, the German armies had reached the outskirts of Moscow, the capital. They had surrounded Leningrad, the newly renamed since 1924, old capital of Petersburg, then Petrograd, now became known as Leningrad. And the German troops began to starve the city by surrounding it, not allowing food to enter, and to bomb it into what they hoped would be eventual submission. German armies also, by November of 1941, had taken most of the Ukraine, the most essential agricultural lands for the Soviet Union. As a result of these rapid advances by the Nazi German forces, 40% of the Soviet population was living under German occupation by November of 1941, and 2 million soldiers were held prisoner. Now, there's lots of explanations about why the USSR was so unprepared. The official Soviet explanation was it was the element of surprise that benefited the Germans. The Soviet people were told officially it was the, and I quote from the official statement, it was the suddenness and perfidiousness of the attack that gave Germans the advantage. Most Soviet leaders, of course, knew much better. And likewise, most historians point to a variety of internal failings within the Soviet system, failings that indeed reveal a great deal about the nature of Soviet politics during the Stalin period. One problem was the quality of the army, and in particular, army leadership. The purges in the army in the late 1930s, which devastated the upper officer corps, indeed the whole officer corps, really rid the army of many of its most experienced officers, especially at the command level. The army also was still poorly supplied, poorly equipped. In fact, most Soviet airplanes and tanks and weapons were terribly out of date, and on top of that, in short supply. In fact, this is one of the reasons, and indeed the symbolism, of the famous Molotov cocktail used so widely by partisan troops in the beginning of the war. They had nothing else to throw at tanks other than bottles filled with explosive liquids, mostly kerosene, and a rag lit at the top. Vyacheslav Molotov, who reportedly suggested this idea, was, of course, the minister